Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, Harold Felder, and today the topic is miracles. And to discuss this topic with me, I have none other than Dr. Gary Habermas. He's an expert on miracles, particularly the miracle of the resurrection. I'm going to give you a little bit of a background, information about Dr. Habermas. He has a PhD from Michigan State University in History and Philosophy of Religion. He's currently Distinguished Professor and Chair, Department of Philosophy and Theology at Liberty University. He's author of 25 books, and just some of them include The Risen Jesus and Future Hope, The Historical Jesus, Ancient Evidence for the Life of Christ, In Defense of Miracles, A Comprehensive Case for God's Action in History, and the list goes on. He has published well over 100 articles and reviews. He's given over 1,000 lectures in almost 100 different colleges, universities, and seminaries, and elsewhere. And that's your background as far as academic, but I also know you have a family, so you can tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Harold, good to be with you today. Yes, I do have a family. My wife, Eileen, and I have 7 children, and we live in Lynchburg, Virginia, and we have 5 grandchildren, and all 7 of our children, and all of our in-laws, and all 5 of our grandchildren all live in our little town of about 200,000 people, so we're happy.
Okay, great, great. So let's get to it. Mm-hmm. What is a miracle?
Well, that's a great question. I teach a 3-hour course on miracles. Actually, I've taught it here at SES before, but just because, I mean, you can hammer it out, you can work on it all your life, and that doesn't mean you have a ready-made definition. It's very, very difficult. I would say something along the line of a miracle is a dynamic event performed by God or David Hume's not horrible here, performed by God or an invisible agent, someone acting on behalf of God, or I even think demons are, I think it's possible for them, but performed by God or another supernatural agent for the purpose of confirming a message. And with regard to the laws of nature, I think miracles, I don't like to say they break the laws of nature, but I think I would say something like they temporarily supersede the laws of nature. Temporarily because, let me use an example. You throw a rock into a pond and it disturbs everything and we get what we call rings or whatever. We get little baby waves. And it goes out further and further and further and pretty soon it's subsumed and the rock goes down to the bottom and everything's calm. I think nature kind of comes back together again after a miracle. So I'd say a dynamic event caused chiefly by God by a temporary cessation of a law of nature for the purpose of confirming a message.
How would we recognize a miracle if we saw one?
Well, that's a great question. You have to have some kind of handles or some kind of identifying signs. And some of those identifying signs, I'll talk about some of the handles, quote-unquote, that Richard Swinburne, philosopher Richard Swinburne, mentions. We're probably better off if it's a one-time event, because if there were, say, a lot of multiplying of loaves and fishes, people would just say, oh, you found a way to multiply loaves and fishes. But he said if there's a unique event, say a virgin birth, a resurrection, a one-time event is probably better than others. Secondly, it supersedes or runs contrary to a known law of nature. And thirdly, no expanding, changing, redefinition of those laws of nature seem to be able to account for the event in any other way. I think that would give us a start. Now, if you would say, well, hey, look, on top of all that, we've got some good evidence for this event, and it seems to evidence a religious message. Now I would say, looks like, you know, maybe we have a candidate here or something like that.
Could you give me an overview of the history of miracles? People, it seems, were more likely to believe in miracles 200 years ago than today. Why? And what happened to change people's perceptions of miracles?
Well, you know what some of the skeptics are going to say is, I'll take David Hume. David Hume says, miracle reports are more common among ignorant and barbarous nations. That's his phrase, ignorant and barbarous nations. But then he says, hey, not all the time, because now he's writing, he's Scottish, and he's writing in England about halfway through the 18th century. And he says, but look, there are some miracle reports by the Jansenists in France just a few decades ago. He says France isn't a backward and ignorant nation. So, but a lot of critics like to make the point that miracles are largely reported among ignorant, you know, unlearned. Hey, get a good dose of science and you won't say that kind of thing. Or get a good dose of medical science and you won't say that. But you know, anymore, Harold, I think this criteria has kind of changed, because we have a generation, just look at the Gallup polls, if that tells you anything, we have a generation that likes to say, yeah, I believe in miracles, I believe in angels, I believe in demons, I believe in, you know, heaven, hell. And it's real popular today to say that people have either, I've seen an angel or a miracle, or I know somebody who's seen an angel, and so on. And I think because some of those claims are noised abroad by fairly intelligent people and occasionally get written up in medical journals, we have a famous double-blind experiment with prayer, answered prayer 15 years ago. I think people are a little more open because I think the climate is open. I mean, let me say it this way. When the New Age movement came in a couple decades ago, Christians said, horrible, horrible, horrible. When postmodernism came in, Christians say, horrible, horrible. Well, you know, they bring in their own problems. But I think both New Age and postmodernism are probably easier to deal with as Christian apologists than the old naturalism, the old sterile, these things can't happen. And I think we have a generation of people who, while not, you know, not Christian necessarily, they believe in prayer, and they believe in praying, and they believe that there are answers, and they believe there is healing, and they believe if you said you saw an angel and gave a good account, they probably wouldn't have an argument. So I think this is, you know, this isn't an ignorant, barbarous time, but I think people believe today more in miracles than they probably did 50 years ago. Just guessing.
You mentioned David Hume. Who right. is he, and what impact has he had on this whole debate about miracles?
Yeah, a huge impact. He is one of three major philosophers called the British empiricists, which followed three continental philosophers called the rationalists. The first group were Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. The second group, Locke, Berkeley, and Hume. And by the way, of those three British empiricists, two of them were very possibly, if not likely, Christians, John Locke and Berkeley. Most likely Christians, but Hume is that one out of the empiricists who's not. He was a skeptic. It's really hard to know. For example, Anthony Flew, who's a David Hume scholar, when I asked Tony one time, do you think David Hume was an atheist? He'd say, no, I don't call him an atheist. I just call him an unbeliever. So I take it that that phrase means there's a little bit of ambiguity. But probably what you're after is about 25 years before he died, and he died right there when America became, right at the time of the Revolution, about 25 years earlier, Hume had written a famous essay called Of Miracles, and it's a little section 10 of his Inquiry, one of his philosophical works. And in that essay, he says, it's always more likely that something else happened, it's not a miracle. He said a lot of other things, but it was a very famous, very influential essay.
Okay, great. You sort of touched on this, but explain, what is the purpose of a miracle?
I think, ideally, the purpose of a miracle is to evidence or to point to a message. Now, I think, fundamentally, a miracle, we often call these things signs. What's a sign mean? A sign is a message that points beyond itself to something else. I think, in that sense, miracles point beyond themselves to something else. I said earlier, I don't have any problem with saying that not all miracles have to be caused by good forces, let's say. If it were caused by a negative something or someone who's anti-God, it could actually evidence a negative message. It could actually evidence a non-biblical message. So you might have the strange twist of a miracle, a negative miracle, evidencing a non-Christian message.
And this raises a very interesting question then, because if a miracle is supposed to be a sign or a confirmation from God, and someone performs a miracle, then how do we know that this is not of God? For instance,
right.
We see the pharaohs, magicians, mm-hmm. in the time of Moses performing miracles.
Right.
Now, a rational person on the outside would maybe say, well, if pharaohs, magicians can do miracles, then why should I not follow Pharaoh?
Yeah. Well, for one thing you have to solve there is if pharaohs, magicians are doing magic or miracle. That's a good question. How do we know they're even doing miracles? But still, I allow the possibility that not all signs are done for positive purposes. And so you could actually, and earlier I didn't say all of them had to be done by God. I said by God or some other invisible agent. I said I actually don't mind that part of David Hume's definition. It's Hume who says performed by God or an invisible agent. So I don't think all of them have to be for for good purposes only. And you raise another point. What about the magic? Could there be imitation miracles? Yeah, I think there could be imitation miracles, too. They could look for all the world like real miracles. But again, you have to bring out some of that criteria and do some testing. And the New Testament talks about that, too.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to read you a quote from the New Testament.
Okay.
And it's actually 2 Thessalonians 2:9, and it says, "The coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders." How can we tell the difference between the counterfeit and the legitimate then? If someone is, you know, around at the end times and we have this guy who's claiming to be the Messiah possibly, and he's performing what look like legitimate miracles, aren't in a way we sort of obligated to follow this person? Because he seems to be confirmed by God.
Well, in two passages in the book of Deuteronomy, one passage, Deuteronomy 13, one passage, Deuteronomy 18, talks about false prophets. And Deuteronomy 18, now these are instructions for Israel, right? And Deuteronomy 18 is the better known of the two passages. If a man claims to be a prophet and he predicts something that doesn't come true, he's betrayed himself in a sense, stone him, because he's shown that he's not God's prophet. But in Deuteronomy 13, very interestingly, it says, even if somebody does a miracle, and then he says, disobey Moses and the prophets. Don't follow him. So now you have some additional tests. You might have a moral test. Here's a moral test. A leader rises up and says, look, I'm going to do miracles. And if you don't believe I'm God, we're going to kill you. Sort of like a scenario that Revelation 13 seems to speak about, and all the discussion today about Antichrist and all that, even today, discussion about Antichrist. All right, what if the person flunks the moral test? Here's a Revelation talks about bringing fire down from heaven in the sight of men, and then says, if you don't bow down and worship me, I'm going to kill you. So you have a flunking of two tests here. A moral test, believe or I'm going to kill you, and a doctrinal test, he says, I'm going to bring this down and believe that I'm, say, the Son of God. Well, Jesus said, many will come in my name and say, I'm here or there, don't believe them. So he flunks both the doctrinal tests and he flunks the moral tests. So there are other handles. There are ways that we can argue which miracles are which.
Yeah. Now, this may sound like an unfair question, and it may be, but I'm just curious because you may actually have an answer.
Okay.
But why would God, do you think, allow people to perform, or Satan or his demonic realm to perform miracles when all it does is confuse people?
I mean, that's almost like asking the broader question. It's part of the pain and evil question. Why does God allow anybody to exercise free will and hurt people? I think basically you're going to get back to the problem of pain and suffering here sooner or later, and I think the answer's got something to do with free will. I think the basic answer, whether it's C.S. Lewis or Alvin Plantinga, basically the answer that says God wanted us to obey and to obey freely, obey lovingly, is the most likely response. In a world where people are free, people drive drunk. And in a world where people are free, people get angry and pull triggers. In a world where people are free, people teach false messages and say they've heard from God. So I think it's part of that free will complex of questions.
Why do you come to the conclusion that Satan can perform miracles or that demons can perform miracles? What leads you to that?
I'm not actually talking about any particular thing out there in society. I'm simply responding. When I said that, I was giving you a biblical definition, and I'm trying to define miracles the way a New Testament writer would define miracles from the perspective of the New Testament. I think if you ask me that question, I think it's pretty clear in those texts. New Testament writers thought that demons could perform miracles. They used the same Greek words of false prophets or, say, messengers of Satan. And if you want to say, well, it's the same word, but that's not the same kind of act, it just seems like we're kind of straining, you know, here to keep a theory intact. So I feel pressed to say that the New Testament definition would include a demon because I think that's what texts teach.
So do you believe then that Satan can heal?
Let's ask that as a New Testament question. In the New Testament, we have this definition of miracles. This is earlier in your interview. And then I've said, yeah, I think the New Testament says Satan could do miracles, demons could do miracles. I think the New Testament says that. What kind of miracles? Well, almost any treatment of miracles, say C.S. Lewis or any other people, Colin Brown, well-known book, they differentiate between type A miracles, type B miracles, type 1 miracles, type 2. I think the New Testament witnesses Satan can do, let's call them lower level miracles, not higher level miracles. I don't think in the New Testament Satan is able to raise the dead. I don't think demons can raise the dead, because those are miracles of creation, and only God creates. Now, does the New Testament speak like Satan could heal? Or, you know, I think those are the kind of things that, according to the New Testament, Satan or demons could do. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, it could be, though, that some types of healing are higher types of healing than other kinds. I think there's a line, but I think it's real hard to say exactly where that line is. Let's say the closer something comes to a creation miracle, I don't think the New Testament talks in terms of demons being able to raise the dead, even if it's a temporary dead, like Lazarus, to die again, not even that form.
Okay.
So I would say there'd be some of the lower level miracles, but still, what's a miracle? It's a sign. Still the kind of things that would draw some oohs and ahs and some attention.
Now, I know you get this question a lot, so I'm asking it because there are a lot of people out there who want to ask you the same question, and that is, okay, how come we don't see biblical-type miracles today? We don't see parting of the Red Sea. We don't see a lot of the things that we read about in the Old Testament.
Yeah, that's a great question, but I do think we see a lot of miracles today. I'm on record saying that I think God is perhaps, if you just want to count times, now maybe not the big events like you're talking about, parting the Red Sea, bringing fire down and consuming sacrifices,
right,
like Elijah. I do think that there are a lot of documented cases today of healing, of answers to prayer, of other supernatural people in certain circumstances and other religions who pray, and God sends them a vision. Cases where, say on the mission field, supernatural preparation for a message is given. There's a lot of examples like that. I'm thinking about Don Richardson's book, Eternity in Their Hearts, where he gives a couple dozen examples. I think those are all around us, and I think we have maybe a supernatural removal from a difficult situation. I'll tell you what, there are a lot of sources, and people could say, oh man, you're going in for anything here. You're believing anything. But I think some good records of this kind of thing, and I repeat, some of the stuff, near-death experiences. Now, I don't think that's a miracle, but I do think near-death experiences where people might just possibly get a look prematurely at heaven. I think these things have been written up in medical journals, so I don't say, oh yeah, I'm gullible and I think all this stuff's happening. I think we have to look at the data and make decisions, but I do think God is very active today.
Okay. A lot of world religions claim miracles. What makes the miracle claims of Christianity any more valid than the claims of other religions?
Sure. Good question. Well, when I'm speaking on the uniqueness of Jesus, very frequently I will make a claim something like this. There's five or six things Jesus did or said that are unique among the world religions. One of those things, I think, is that Jesus is the only founder of a major world religion of whom miracles are recorded within a generation. And you say, well, all right, I had a critic say to me one time, responded after I did a debate, this is actually in print, my first debate with Anthony Flew, and it's published by Harper and Row, and the guy said, the philosopher Charles Hartshorne said, hey, I don't want to believe in the miracles of Jesus because that makes me believe in the miracles of Buddha. And I said, well, okay, wait a minute. Let's ask the question of what's your data here. Let's ask the normal historical question we ask. What data do we have for Jesus? Well, you may be surprised, but today, most critical scholars believe that in some sense, Jesus was a miracle worker. Jesus was believed to be a miracle worker, at least in two senses, that he was an exorcist and that he healed. Now, they could say psychosomatic or whatever, but they believe that circumstances like those recorded in the Gospels happened. All right, now what's our account of these? Well, Mark would be no later than 40 years later. But what about Buddha? Well, our earliest reports of Buddha's miracles, our earliest reports of about anything from Buddha, happened hundreds of years later. So I'm not saying there are no reports that founders of religions did miracles. I'm saying those reports are late enough or questionable enough without the significant amount of data that we have for the miracles of Jesus.
Right, right. I've actually run into Christians who say they don't believe in miracles. How do you respond to that?
Right now or biblical miracles?
Oh, yes. Within the last couple of months.
Yeah, well, I let them have their own view. If that's their view, they can hold it. But I don't think it does justice either to the biblical data or to the phenomena we see in the world today associated. Remember I talked early here in the program about handles. I don't think it's the best response either to biblical miracles or to the checks and balances that we have to check these miracles, you know, in the world today, that we can check them out. So I think both for the reason that the Bible makes us think that they are out there, and secondly, that they do pass these tests, I think I have to affirm them.
Yeah, and the thing that gets me about that is, how do you call yourself a Christian if you can't believe in the miracle on which the faith is based, on the resurrection?
Oh, we're talking about creation, or we're talking about resurrection, or we're talking about virgin birth. We're getting pretty close to the center. And anybody knows anything about me, I mean, 13 of my 26 books are on the resurrection of Jesus. And so, yeah, I mean, I think we can stand toe-to-toe with anybody who questions data for the resurrection, and we can say, no, let's just debate this the way we would debate any kind of historical event. And I'll use criteria that you think are historical as a critic. I'll use your criteria, and I still think we have enough evidence to say that Jesus was raised.
Yeah, if there's no miracles, there's no resurrection, there's no Christianity.
Yeah, well, you're right. In that famous passage in 1 Corinthians 15:14, and again in verse 17, Paul says, if Christ is not raised, our faith is vain. So yeah, if you want to say something like the resurrection didn't happen, I think there's some tremendous implications for the Christianity, or the lack of Christianity.
Yeah. I wanted to just mention one argument, one objection. You already touched on it when you were talking about David Hume, but this one is a little bit different. It's from Spinoza, and it basically goes like this. Miracles are a violation of natural laws. Natural laws are immutable. It is impossible to violate immutable laws. Therefore, miracles are impossible.
Yeah. Spinoza wrote that before Hume wrote his, and Hume has some similarities to that, but Spinoza has that emphasis, as you just read, on immutable laws, and that's because of Spinoza's rationalism and him trying to think there was mathematical precision in nature. I don't think today we see that. I think laws of nature are probably statistical descriptions of what generally occur given situations X, Y, Z. I think that's what laws of nature are. They are what usually, for example, gravity. So how can you throw a ball in the air? Or better yet, how can you shoot a space satellite or something up there? It doesn't even come back down. Or it goes to the other parts of the solar system. How do you do that? You do it by greater force. And so I think to say there's immutable laws really doesn't answer the question. I like C.S. Lewis here in his book on miracles. The question is not how strong the laws of nature are. The question is, can God overcome the laws of nature or set them aside temporarily? I think it's silly to ask about the strength of the immutable laws of nature, so to speak. We should be asking about God and whether he's omnipotent and omniscient. If God is stronger than the laws of nature, you basically have a situation here where God can do what he wants, and laws don't keep him out. It's like saying, Harold, that door over there is locked, man. You're not getting in there. And you push and you push and you push, and the door doesn't come open. You bring a bulldozer in, and my, how easy does that door open?
Right.
Doors open with greater power, and I think the laws of nature can't keep God out if God's God. And then if God's God, we know that a miracle could happen. And then if I have good evidence, I say that a miracle did happen.
How can people get in contact with you, Dr. Habermas?
I have a website, www.GaryHabermas.com, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-S. And I have a number of audio and video on site. We've got some book material and some essays, and I have a long Q&A section.
Thank you for being on the show, Dr. Gary Habermas,
talking
about miracles. And that will end this edition of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless. The preceding show has been sponsored by Giving an Answer with Harold C. Felder. You can get a CD of today's show free of charge by simply going to givinganswer.org. You can also contact us at 704-248-7840 or by mail at Giving an Answer, P.O. Box 1972, Matthews, North Carolina, 28106. That phone number again is 704-248-7843. And remember, this show will only stay on the air by your prayers and financial support. Be sure to join me again next time on Giving an Answer.